Well, hello again, everyone. Welcome to Satsang with G. Those of you who have just come from the Sri and Kira show, I'm very, very happy you're here. I'm sure you'll get a lot out of this as well to fit in with your spiritual Sunday afternoon. That's one of the reasons I chose this time slot, which is 4 in the afternoon in New York, where I am. It's 1 o'clock in the afternoon in California, where the radio show originates from, and it's like 9 o'clock in London. So I chose this time because this is just a great time. I remember, you know, when I was younger, I used to hate this time on Sunday. It was always such a lull, and now I just really love the quiet of it. I think it's so wise that we give ourselves permission to just really be with ourselves quietly, to truly be with ourselves, to ponder the deeper questions of life. And that's what satsang is all about. It's, you know, the satsang is really with yourself. Satsang is a beautiful word that just means communing with your own inner truth, however you may perceive that. And a level of devotion that allows you to kind of, not kind of, but really cut through the stuff we believe about ourselves to find the stuff that's really true about ourselves, which is always way better than we think it's going to be. As always, I'm wide open for... is it sounding... Can you check on Facebook Live and see if it's very loud? It might be.
Go back.
The subject for today, and by the way, just to always remind people, there's a number that you can call into if you'd like to actually talk and ask a question, and that number is 888-627-6008, and that's obviously a toll-free number in the U.S. and in Canada. Sorry, we don't have anything for you, the international people, but by all means, just chat your questions in Facebook or YouTube if you're there. And that number is for calling in to speak, not to find out the actual numbers for how to listen on the phone. And those are available as well. So I called this show, "The Mind is a Thought and Not a Thinker." And it's really important for us to understand. You know, we have turned the mind into really an object in and of itself. It is and this is the way the mind works. And you know what the mind is really, it is just a word that we have given to a very complex process. There's no such thing as a mind. Right? There's not like this little object here that's generating thoughts, you know, especially devious thoughts, right? That it's hiding in the bushes to grab you and mess up your life. You know, we want to try to quiet our mind as if there was this thing that you called the mind that you could somehow grab and contain. The mind is nothing more than an abstraction. It is a word used to designate patterns of thought, the process of thinking happening. So the mind isn't thinking. It is just the word that represents thinking, which is a very complex process. It's like the example I love to use is the wind, right? We say the wind is blowing, as if there's this object over here, wind, that is pushing air. Wind refers to simply the motion of air. Or, you know, a river, we say the river, right? Well, and a river is just, you know, billions upon billions of gallons of water that are moving. There's not a thing called a river. Matter of fact, there's the old Zen saying, you can't put your foot into the same river twice. This is important because when we take something like the word mind and we turn it into an object, the moment something becomes an object, you begin to make up stories about it. Before the show started, Judy, as one of my students in Inner Reconciliation Level 2, was commenting about a whole section I do called The Storyteller Mind. And it is natural, very natural. One of the things that the human being does is make up a narrative to fit every circumstance, even if, especially if you don't know what's actually happening. It's really quite funny, but we'll make it up and believe it at the same time. We not just make it up, we don't realize that it's purely fictional. You're making something up at the time. You make it up and believe it simultaneously. This is so amazing to discover, because when you do, you realize that all you're actually dealing with is not a thing, but a pattern of conditioned thoughts, a particular way that the thoughts happen to occur to you. There's immediately a sense of distance that happens when you realize that you're not dealing with a thing. This is even more true in kind of how intense and afraid people are of the unconscious mind or the subconscious mind. It's simply the nature of thought, the way thinking works, to make abstractions. That's what it's called. It's an abstraction. It's something too complex to think about as it actually is. So we abstract it. We make a word that represents something really, really complex and big. And then we use that word, which is great, right? You know, the word body. I say the word body, everybody knows me. You say the word dog, everybody knows what you mean. We don't have to go into great detail describing every little thing until somebody finally identifies that you're talking about a dog. It's a great shorthand. And it's essential to language, and it's essential to being able to communicate. But it also includes in it this capacity to take something which is an abstraction and give it a reality that it doesn't actually possess. It doesn't. The mind does not have most of the qualities that we assign to it. There is no mind that is fighting you, that is arguing with you, that is resisting you, that is refusing to be quiet when you want it to be quiet, that is intruding upon you. There's nothing there doing it. But the belief that there is actually creates the experience and the sensations within the body that makes it seem as if it is. Again, the way the energy system works, the way the whole nervous system works, is because the cognitive parts of us, the parts of us that are aware of thinking and, that are working with thoughts and symbolic representation and that sort of thing, they can only handle so much information. My understanding is that the entire nervous system, all the senses put together, are receiving about 60 billion bits of information per second. It is just a constant stream of information, of sensory input. The cognitive part of us, which is the most recent thing, if you look at it from the point of view of neurology, it's the most recent thing to arrive, it can process 60 bits a second. So there's this enormously complex process going on that reduces the 60 billion that's actually happening down to the 60 bits that we can handle cognitively, and all the rest of it gets filtered out. Well, how does it get filtered out? It gets filtered out by the stories it creates. It creates, not even you. You get the story. You're the last one to hear the punchline, by the way. This all happens absolutely automatically. Now, that doesn't mean once we become aware of it, we can't get a little bit more control over the process by where we put our emphasis. But first, we really have to understand that we're kind of flying blind. The amount of information you have gotten upon which you have based your view of the world and most importantly, upon which you have based your view of yourself, is a fraction of what's actually going on. And let's not forget that that 60 billion bits a second being received by your senses, your senses are only receiving a minuscule fraction of all the information that's actually out there. I mean, just take example for light, which your eyes can see. It's just a small little band in the middle of this incredibly large bandwidth of the various frequencies of light. And based on that, we decide what the world is, what the truth is, what you are, what I am, what's up, what's going on, what's important, what's not. And then when you add into it for that, in that little 60 bits in our modern world that is just completely inundated with social media and stuff like this, there's all sorts of things that are vying for that, for getting the lion's share of the attention of what even remains. Have you ever considered the possibility that not only is the mind not a thinker, that there actually isn't a thinker at all? That there's nothing there generating thoughts? That the patterns of thoughts are just more conditioning? They're just more of the functioning of life? Now, I know that's kind of can shake people up because we think of ourselves as being the one thinking our thoughts. We are the thinkers, right? We're the choosers, we're the deciders. And yet, when you look really closely, can you actually find the point at which you thought the thought? Trace any thought back to its beginning and you'll find emptiness. There's nothing there. The thought just appeared. And then another thought pops up right after that that says, well, I had that thought, which is itself just another thought. Now, this shouldn't seem so difficult. I mean, there's no buddy beating your heart, you know? There's no little people there. It's not something you think about. There's nobody there growing hair or digesting your food or getting this, you know, convincing the cells they need to absorb nutrition from the blood, convincing the lungs that they need to absorb air. There's nothing there doing that. Why do we insist that there must be a thinker? That there must be some kind of doer of deeds and thinker of thoughts? That's interesting, because what then would be the alternative? Partner at Masterheart is just put a link up there on Facebook that the sound is much better on YouTube. For some reason, it's just the connection. The settings are the same as they were last week, but they seem to be coming up much louder on Facebook this time. But they're fine on BBS Radio, so we'll press on. So many of you may never have actually been exposed to this kind of thinking. And as I like to point out, I'm open to any kind of questions. Questions about, you know, about your personal life, your relationships and finances, and anything that is weighing on your heart that you want to discuss from a spiritual perspective, I am totally open to it. But I love to begin satsang by setting the stage for the deepest possible inquiry, because you realize everything we experience in life, whether it be a great life or a mediocre life or a very painful life, is a direct result of the image we hold of ourselves. And that picture we're holding of ourselves and believing is quite literally determining the entire quality and character of our experience. As I said, there's the 60 bits a second that can only be processed cognitively has to have mechanisms by which things are filtered out. That mechanism is what we call our beliefs, our self-image. That self-image is the number one thing that tells the energy system, this is important, it needs to get in, this is unimportant, this I don't really need to see this. And it dutifully does it. So from the point of view of you sitting up here with your 60 bits a second, you are seeing a confirmation of the very thing that you have been believing. But the good news is this. There's a deeper part of us. There's something much deeper than the mind, much deeper than thinking, much deeper than merely our perception of things, our beliefs about things. Because the very fact that I can talk about this and we can sit together and look at it, and we can look at the functioning of the mind, means that there's something else here that isn't the mind, something that is more than thought. The very fact that we can talk about thoughts means there's something there that's looking at them, something that is more than thoughts. Back in the 1970s, I believe it was, when anesthesia had gotten to the point where they could do brain surgery with the people still awake. So people were quite conscious. I mean, I saw one picture of some guy playing his guitar while they were operating on his brain. And because they could do that, they could open up the brain and the person could talk. There was one neurologist in particular, a neurosurgeon, who used an electric probe to stimulate various parts of the brain, and he mapped all the functions. All the function, we know that, you know, certain things are originating this part of the brain and other. He's the guy that mapped all that. And he said that he could, with a very subtle probe and a little bit of energy, he could pretty much get the person to do whatever he wanted them to, laugh, cry, say something, smile, move their arms, all the functioning. Except one, and it really got him, because no matter how much he did or how he did it or the way he did it, he could get it to do anything, but he couldn't make the person want to do it. They always knew it was happening to them. Now, what's really remarkable about this guy, a strict materialist, neurologist, scientist, his conclusion was the mind, consciousness, is not in the body, that it is something else, a different substance altogether. And that, to me, is the essence of spiritual inquiry. You know, spirit is the opposite of matter. It is immaterial. It is formless. You know, when people think of spirits, they think of a spirit, right, which is basically, you know, a person with a body that's, you know, translucent and you can stick your hand through it. That sort of thing. But that's just kind of a subtler form. Spirit really means formless, right? Outside of space and time. It doesn't occupy space, doesn't occupy time. It is just, and yet it is. It is just pure presence, pure being without having a form. Now that's impossible for your mind to conceive. It is impossible for thought to grasp that, because thought is nothing but the manipulation of objects. So don't even bother trying. Just realize that incidents like that guy experienced and your own direct experience of looking at your thoughts, just turn around for a second and go, who's looking at them? What is it that is aware of thought? What is it that is aware of emotion? What is it that's aware of the sensation that is the body? What is that? Especially when you even have somebody with the scientific credibility saying, I could find no evidence that consciousness was actually in the body, which is really a remarkable statement coming from there, because the predominant view is that consciousness is a function of the body, that consciousness originates in matter. Boy, I've come a long way from the beginning thing here of the mind is a thought. Everything we take to be solid and real and substantial and an object that exists independently of our perception of it needs to be questioned. Because how do you get to something that is outside of your perception? How do you step outside of your perception and validate the existence of something separate from your perception? Everything we know of is in our consciousness. That's all we know. I mean, think about that. Everything appears to you. The consciousness that's hearing my voice right now, that's listening to my words, that is feeling, you know, the chair underneath you, the place where everything is registered. So I've pointed out, I mean, this microphone I'm speaking into, it doesn't hear me. it's not hearing anything. There's no consciousness there. We keep the whole thing through the wires, to the internet, to the speakers, to the headphones you're listening on. But what about the ear? The eardrum that's vibrating, is that hearing me? The nerves that are turning it into electrical impulse, is that hearing? The brain that's processing it and associating and do all sorts of things with it, is that hearing? You ask that neurosurgeon, he would say, no, it's not, something else is. What's that? That's what satsang is. Satsang is the willingness to ask that question. I've got a question here from Shanika. Oh, by the way, yeah, just let me say it again. 888-627-6008. I will entertain questions about anything, anything at all. Let's see. Question from Shanika on YouTube. Namaste, GP. Lovely to see you again. Lovely to see you too, Shanika. My question is, does the enlightened person really see a different world compared to an ordinary person? Is it just a way of thinking? Did Buddha say the same? Boy, there's such a big misunderstanding about enlightened or the enlightened person. Let me just ask a real simple question first. Do you see the same world as your cat? Do you see the same world as the person who is closest to you? Similarities, yes, but do you see the same world? To quote Muji, he said, there's one earth, there's 8 billion worlds. Everybody lives within their own private world, our own private set of assumptions and perceptions, all based on how we see things due to the particular thoughts that are active, the experiences we've had, the associations and memories. When you realize exactly how complex all of the processing and subtleties and nuances of our perceptions are, you realize that nobody sees the world like somebody else. And don't we even talk like that? You know, we talk about somebody who's extremely wealthy. Well, they don't live in my world. Or we think about somebody, you know, maybe somebody's living in Pakistan, you know, a family of eight living in one room. So that's a very different world from mine. And yes, it is. Completely different experience, completely different set of perceptions. Right? Now, which is the world? Right? We assume that out there somewhere there's the world, and that, you know, eventually we're going to see it. Even the best scientific minds have said that's not really possible. We are completely imprisoned within our perceptions. Now, the spiritual point of view says, well, yes and no. You're not imprisoned there. The enlightened person, that is, and let me explain that to anybody here who's maybe, you know, a different idea of spirituality practice, you know, other kinds of practices and that sort of thing. Enlightenment simply means that you are experiencing things without all the conditioning in between. That is, you're not showing up into life with a private agenda. You're not trying to make life do your bidding. You're very childlike. It's like being a little kid. Little kids, you know, they don't see the same world that we do, but they don't have any expectations either. And so they have a level of delight with what happens that we don't, because we have all these expectations that have been laid on top of it. And their whole experience of it is showing up without any expectation, without any judgment, without any agenda, and without trying to force it to their will. And so their experience is akin to the enlightened person. The difference is the enlightened person has gone through the delusion, has suffered like the rest, and then realized you're suffering not from what was actually there, the circumstances themselves, but from all the mountain of beliefs and conditioned responses to it that were programmed into the nervous system, at which point that one begins to remove their sense of identity, all of their opinions, their judgments, their beliefs. They become very humble, very, very willing to listen, very brave in challenging assumptions. And the end result is they end up showing up in life without an agenda. So while the two of you, a completely deluded person and a completely awakened person, could be sitting having exactly the same experience as far as what was going on in front of them, their internal experience would be completely different. Where one might be, you know, really feeling troubled and distraught and frustrated that things aren't going the other way, their way, the other will be just absolutely flowing with it and having a really good time. So because if there's no expectation, I'm totally open to be surprised at every single moment. And there's another part of that which is even more important. Because you see, when we are locked in a particular view, a particular perception, a particular view of things, whenever we show up, there's this unconscious, energetic attempt to make the circumstances conform to our way of seeing them. And there's all sorts of subtle and overt ways we try to do that. Overt ways are aggression, or, you know, people trying to grab control. And I'm sure you've all experienced people like that. And, you know, a meeting, they want to take control, or at work sometimes bosses can be like that. They're just trying to force things into their will. And we all do. We have subtle ways of doing it. Manipulation and that sort of thing, passive aggression, which we don't even, you know, something we don't even realize that we're doing. All we're trying to do is get the world to conform to our view of it so that we will feel as if we're right and therefore safe, which is why we do it. The sage, the one whose eyes have been opened and doesn't do that anymore, finds something really remarkable. Finds that when they show up to a circumstance without an agenda, brand new, fresh resources, inner abilities, inner powers emerge to respond to whatever is happening. It's not that they're vacant. It's not that they're not present. They're fully present, but they're also totally responsive. So now there's no need to force it into anything. You let it play the way it's playing, and you go with it. It's kind of like when I used to play a lot of music, especially when we do a lot of improvisation and the like. I mean, one of the keys is you just keep going. Somebody goes somewhere, you follow. Somebody else leads, you follow, right? And you enhance it, and you play off each other. In theater sports, which is a system of learning improvisational theater, which I did a little bit of, which is very fun. One of the number one rules is you never say no. You never resist. However outlandish, however weird, however out there, completely surprising the other actor does, or the suggestion from the audience is, you say yes to it and go. Because the no shuts it down. The no tries to force it into an agenda. Now, it's very powerful, because in order for that to happen, the moment you hear it, the impulse, then you let go of the no and you just go with it, and you have no idea where it's going to go. It may go someplace really wonderful. It may just fall off the cliff and be absolutely uninteresting. You don't really know, but that's the joy of it. And little kids do that all the time. They call it play. They do it all the time. It's natural to us. When your storyteller mind is liberated, that's what it does. It just plays. It becomes characters as the moment requires. So when you come into life without an agenda, you discover power within you that you didn't realize you had. You discover abilities that emerge because the moment calls for them. That, by the way, is the key to a good relationship as well. A relationship that lasts is where you actually show up at the relationship without an agenda and respond in the moment. And new, fresh things happen. You become a different person, which means, you know, they fall in love with you all over again. hopefully. I think I may have exhausted that. Please don't, when people hear the stories of the awakened sages and masters, and by the way, that's a different class. A sage is a different class than the yogic masters, the guys who levitate and, you know, make objects appear and do all sorts of mystical city stuff. Very rarely do real sages do any of that. The real sages are present as ordinary human beings. And as you mentioned about, is that what the Buddha said? As far as I know, the answer is yes. That is what the Buddha said. And he even said the ordinary human being is the Buddha. And that the ultimate achievement was the total acceptance of your humanness, not a transcendent state, not an altered consciousness, but a total embrace of your life just as it is. No overhead. And of course, that's what Christ referred to as turning water into wine. The everyday mundane stuff suddenly takes on the glow of divinity. And to quote the Sufi, they say, everywhere the eye lands, it sees the face of God. And that's the beauty of that. You get to see the truth in everything and everyone, because you're fully there, without an agenda, without a memory. You're not showing up as a memory or as a picture of what you are. You're showing up completely empty, naked, just you. And then the moment happens. Let's see. That's all, folks. GP, would you say the personality is just leftover ignorance? Again, let's not confuse it. Every human form, every human being has a uniqueness about them, right? Every form is different. Every snowflake is different. Every person has different gifts and talents and abilities, and they speak differently and they walk differently. I mean, you know, our fingerprints are different. Our voices are all, I mean, every single thing, the amount of diversity is just staggering. That individuality, that uniqueness, that one of a kindness, that one without a secondness, is the beauty of the particular human life that you are leading right now. The moment you project upon that the sense that this is what I am, and your consciousness begins to condition itself around it. So it's saying, oh, I'm this and I can't be anything other than that. And gets these ideas of lack and being constricted. Seeing it is nothing more than just how you are appearing in the moment, not what you ultimately are, not what you essentially are, but how what you are essentially are is appearing in this moment. That is what is regarded as the person, the separate self, the sense of being somebody separate from somebody else. It's really, really important to distinguish between what is really there, which is the individuality and uniqueness and beauty, which is all an expression of the one beingness that we all have in common, but are all expressing differently, and enjoy the sheer beauty of that, the wonder of that, the color and art of it, the symphony orchestra of it, all the different things working together in harmony. But know that you are the unity, you are the essence of it, and that you are not confined to it. Any more than Mozart, you know, wrote one piece and that was it. He was confined to that one piece. Or Leonardo da Vinci climbed into the Mona Lisa and was never heard from again. That which expresses that oneness, which is the human form, is not a limit to it, is not a container for it. The spirit is infinite, but the oneness expresses itself in the many. And so we see the one in the many. And you couldn't see the one without the many. That's the sheer paradox of it, the thing the mind just kind of spins on, because this is not a manipulation of objects that you can grasp. Because that which is actually being expressed is itself completely invisible cannot be seen. I always use the example of light. Light in its purest form cannot be seen. It's only when a part of it appears, part of it's absorbed and part of it's reflected, that an object appears. And then we see that object, and the object changes as the light changes. And that which you call you, when you say, oh, this is me, you'll notice that it's constantly changing. You're not that. You are what is looking at that. But that also means that being the one looking at it, you are now free to inhabit that and enjoy it. I enjoy being me. You know, I enjoy the fact that this particular body mind seems to lend itself well for sitting in front of cameras and talking and doing some other stuff. I have some other things. I mean, there's a lot of stuff it couldn't do. I mean, I was horrendous at sports. I was just horrendous at a lot of things, just really bad. You know, I'm terrible at accounting and money and stuff like that. I just don't want to pay any attention to it. But this I'm really good at, which is great because that's where my inclinations lie. So I get to enjoy it, but not get stuck there. I hope that really answers your question. Personality is personality and expression of the universe. Is personality an expression of the universe? Yes. When we see it as the expression of the universe, we liberate it. You liberate your own abilities and stuff. You get to be all. You get this is allowed to be everything that is. The piano's tuned and can be played now. Right? When you think of it as myself, that I'm contained within this, I'm stuck, and the limitations of the body are my limitations, you've created the personality. You've created the separate self. Imagined, it's not real, but you're going to experience it as if it is real because you are believing in it. So everything is an expression of the one. The idea that the expression exists independently of the one is the essence of the belief in the person. That is the essence of the separate self. That doesn't exist. But that is just a thought projected upon that which does exist, which is the infinite variation and variety and diversity of the manifest universe, which is simply God thinking about himself, if you want to put it that way. You know, the one pondering its own nature. Let's see, Indus, why is it that most of the time I feel that there is no one else out there? Because there isn't. Even when I look at someone, that I have some perception that there is no one there. That's actually quite good because when you believe yourself to be contained within the body, you believe everybody else is. So you're going to look around and you're going to see nothing but people contained in bodies. And you're going to interact with them. And since most people do believe that, that's where all our interactions are. One body trying to get something from another body. There isn't anybody there. That is, there's no person anywhere. It's all a projection. You project it on yourself and you project it on others. Others believe it to be themselves and they project it on you. There really isn't anyone. And when I say there's no one there, it's not vacuous. The person isn't there, right? The person is an idea we've projected on what is there. What is there is the one, is the divine being, the one, you know, God, if you want to call it that. The Buddha nature, the one indivisible, irreducible consciousness. That's what's actually there. That is what's acting. That's what's, you know, sitting here listening to me. That's what's speaking right now. That's what's hearing. That's what these wires are that apparently are carrying this. That is everything you're seeing. The chair you're sitting on is all that. We simply project on that the belief in a separate self. And so it appears as if it exists separate from us. It's an illusion. It's not real. It's not true. Oh, I try to emphasize, because when people say, well, there's no person, there's nobody there, right? And I think you kind of intimated that. I feel like there's no one else out there. There is only one out there. There's one self. One soul, one infinite spirit, looking at itself in countless numbers of ways. So it's not that there's nobody there, right? That, but what you're looking at is yourself. And what's looking back at you is yourself. Say this every single way I possibly can, so it sinks in. You get back to me if it's not getting clear. Here's one from one of my favorite handles, Undead Con Sparrow. This is great. GP, is expectation agenda part of your energy system, one of the seven chakras? Do we need to do IR with it? Thanks. IR meaning inner reconciliation on it. The expectation and agenda, yes, it is. It's part of the energy of what I've called the storyteller. And I don't have enough time to go into it in great depth. I only got about 15 minutes here. And I have to go into the whole storyteller thing. But as I said before, it's this capacity we have to basically create ideas about our circumstances, especially when it's a circumstance we don't understand. We create an idea about it, a story about it, and then we believe that story, and that makes us feel safe. That story we create is always coming from memory. It's always the past, so it's never present. It's never real. It's never really here and now. That is a natural function within us. And it's a beautiful function. The storyteller is responsible for books and movies and myths and legends and all sorts of things. The storyteller gets you a date, right? I mean, the storyteller, you see it active in children pretending. I mean, it is a beautiful thing when it is not burdened with the defense mechanism, where it's trying to create somebody to feel safe and survive in a world of a bunch of somebodies. When it is being activated by that sense of being a separate self, that is what happens. And yes, inner reconciliation, for those of you who don't know what that is, that's a process I created. You can learn more about that. Go to gpwalsh.com/IR, and you can actually get a free course, a free two-hour workshop on it called You're Not Broken. And what it means is that we can't fight with these energies. We have to understand them. And when we understand them, we realize that the storyteller becomes a problem when it is defensive mode. If we can create an environment in which it isn't in defensive mode, you get childlikeness and playfulness. So yes, it needs to be reconciled with. You can't just dismiss it because it's a functioning of the system, right? Another one of the myths of enlightenment is suddenly how everything just, you know, is light and angels are singing and that sort of thing. And there's no more conditioning or anything. It's simply not true. As long as there's a body and there's a mind, there is conditioning. There's a sense of identity arising. There's a sense of being somebody that's going to arise. It's just that the awakened mind, the awakened one, has become so aware of it that they no longer fall for that. It just passes by. Which means, once again, they're completely present with their own energy system. They're present with the storyteller, the peacemaker, all the energies that live inside of us are not a problem anymore. And they're allowed to function perfectly, and they never run the show. And that's how the whole thing gets resolved. So, yes, it is one of the seven chakras. The storyteller is the third chakra in that system. The seat of person, the sense of ego, the sense of I, the sense of self, the ultimate story. And when it is in defensive mode, it creates the sense of being a separate self, and then defends that self as if it's actually true. You could think of awakening as the liberation of the storyteller, and that sense of I returns back home to you, to the center. Oh, gosh, lots of questions. again, 888-627-6008 for those of you who are joining me on BBS Radio or anywhere, any of these, you know, whether it be Facebook or YouTube or any of them, you can call in and I'll be happy to actually speak with you, which would be kind of fun. Okay, here's one from Andre. Why do I still feel the same age when I'm getting older and older? And why can't I say the exact age I feel? That's great. Because you're not getting older. your body is, which is simply a natural process of the various functions of the body. I mean, it's simply a pattern of energy that is going to sustain itself. It's called is capable of sustaining itself, replenishing itself, reproducing itself over a period of time, and then it runs out of steam and it stops and it ends. It has its cycle. The reason you feel like you haven't aged is because you haven't. And I'd ask anybody here, right? I don't ask anybody to believe me about anything. Check it out for yourself. Just go back and revisit in your memory various parts times of your life. And notice the circumstances were different. The feelings running through your system were different. But was the consciousness that was aware of your experience at the time, was that any different? If you really do it, you notice, oh my God, it's never changed. It has been the only constant. It's been the constant that has been there the entire time. That constant is the pure, undifferentiated, real consciousness. That's what you are. That consciousness identified itself with the things that were going on in front of it, and that's where all the problems came from. But you notice when you feel it, as Andre has, I'm not aging. You're not. That's why it feels that way. You're not. And you can't say what age you are because you don't have one. You are timeless. Now that's one to really ponder, huh? It's not even immortal. You are time. You're not in time. Remember, time is nothing but the measurement of change. You as consciousness never change. For you are beyond time. You don't exist in time. Events exist in time. They have a beginning, a middle, and an end. You are the witness of the beginning, the middle, and the end, which means you're not in time. Time consumes everything happening, the body, the mind, everything. It can't consume you. You're the witness of it. So it's a beautiful perception. Put your attention there more. Really start anchoring your sense of identity in that ageless thing that you're so aware of. Don't even try to describe it. Don't even the word consciousness, don't do that. Because you're directly experiencing it. Go to that experience. Let yourself abide there. Because that's your true self. Abide there. Let the sense of I, which is constantly identifying itself with what it sees, just turn it around and bring it back home. Every time it wants to identify itself, just, come back here. I am what is seeing all the change. Clearly, you are what's witnessing the change. The buck stops there. That is consciousness. That is the self. It's so simple. In religious terms, they call it God, being. That's the divine being, not a being, but being itself, beingness, presence. Love it. Love it, love it, love it, love it, love it. Amir Pat. How can we change our current expression as to manifesting our desired state of being and not allow a lack or resistance to stop it? Great question. The answer is the lack. Lack is a belief. We have to stop believing in it, right? We're seeing lack as an actual state that somehow I've got to make some manipulation in my mind or in my energy or my vibration that is going to change that state to one of abundance. It's not a circumstance that needs to be changed. It is the belief itself, and the essence of that belief is believing that you are a separate self. Ultimately, even while you're still believing you're a separate self, you can make really huge inroads in overcoming and seeing that the belief in lack creates the experience of lack. But the ultimate transcendence is when we see that we are not lacking in the slightest because there's no lack in you. You are the source of everything. You know, like law of attraction teachings and the like, they like to talk about source energy as if it was something other than you. It's you. You're it. You are the source energy. that consciousness that is timeless I was just talking about is the source of all of the rest of it. It is that which is producing all the stuff that you see. So the first thing is to recognize that the belief in lack came first, and it was followed by the experience. Now, what we try to do then is try to manipulate the experience to have a different kind of experience, and thus try to convince ourselves that we've overcome lack. The experience always follows the belief, so we have to challenge the belief. Is there such a thing as lack, or is it just a belief I'm holding on to? Now, there's going to be resistance to that because we've all been really deeply trained to believe the evidence in front of our senses as being causative rather than reflective. And in fact, it is the other way around. Belief creates experience. Experience doesn't create belief. Belief always comes first. So the idea of manifesting is the desired state of being. Ultimately, the question is, find out who you are. And you'll realize that you are beyond all states. All states come and go, and you witness them come and go, and you yourself are not a state. That is perfect peace, perfect stillness, the ultimate abundance, the ultimate fulfillment. Beyond that, short of that, you'll find that when you begin to realize that it is your beliefs, your thoughts, and the like that are creating the states, you will stop trying to manipulate states and just notice the energy within you that is creating the state. So if I'm feeling unhappy right now, I can just turn, okay, from where is this unhappiness arising? Unhappiness is always a projection of our happiness on some condition or object that we don't have. We've made happiness conditional rather than a characteristic of ourselves. And I've gone in pursuit of the happiness, and therefore I'm experiencing misery. That's always the case. So every time you feel unhappy, it needs to start becoming the cue to turn around and going, where am I projecting my happiness outside of myself? And now you've begun to look at the right place. You begin to bring your attention back to the center, back to the actual cause of the states. I think that's the best way I could put it. And ultimately, when you discover who you are, you find you are beyond all states, and therefore all states come and go and become totally irrelevant to you. You don't seek a state. You don't even need them. And yet they come and go without a problem. Wow. Boy, a nice long list here. Everybody's really active on YouTube. I wonder if everybody bailed on... Yeah, I think everybody bailed on Facebook because it was so... Because I guess the sound was bad. Thanks, GP. Love from Amsterdam. Oh, wow. Andre from Amsterdam. Wonderful. Let's see. Yes, thanks. Love from Wembley. Indus is in Wembley. Oh, wonderful. I really want to visit that. No, it's never in Wembley. Let's see. Wow, a thought is a manipulation of objects. Didn't fully understand this. I hope you do now. yeah, that's what thought is. It is the manipulation of the symbolic representation of objects. And you'll find that all perception is objects of the mind. In fact, if you ever decide to go through my inner reconciliation training, getting into reconciliation level 3, I completely break down the whole perceptive mechanism till you see that there's nothing but perception. There isn't a world. There isn't a body. There's nothing out there objectively. It is all in here. And what I mean by that is that it's not there's no world. It's just that the world as an object doesn't exist separate from you, the perceiver of it, and everybody else as well. So it's like suddenly having the entire world and as your family, and they're all with you in your room, and you're listening to the radio and dancing and stuff. It's not the experience of being alone. It's the experience of being one. And the immensity of that oneness is just intimate, because it's not out there immense. It is my own immensity. So the depths to which this can go is pretty stunning. And I'm getting my high sign now. Very inspirational, GP. Thank you. Can we also do IR on thoughts? Yes, absolutely you can. So I want to thank everybody for being here. This concludes this week's edition of Satsang with G. I hope you've enjoyed it. I sure love the questions. Please share this video on Facebook and also on YouTube, and tell people about it. It really helps grow the audience. And if you want to learn more about inner reconciliation, gpwalsh.com/IR will get you the free course, You're Not Broken. If you just do a /SWG, I can register to make sure you get notified about these satsangs. I've got all sorts of free programs and courses. I'm doing a new course on the chakras this week, called the Official Chakra Guidebook, How to Use Inner Reconciliation in Your Chakra System. That's happening this week. I think it's going to be gpwalsh.com/chakra. If not, it will be as soon as I get off the air here. So thank you all. Thank you all so much for being here. It's always such a pleasure and an honor to share this time with you. And I'll see you next week.